The Guardian.
The Guardian has partnered with audible.co.uk to offer listeners a free audiobook if you sign up for a 2-week trial of their service. Audible has 40,000 titles available to download. For all the details, follow the links at guardian.co.uk/audible.
Welcome back to another Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. This week we go out and about to the launch of the British Independent Film Awards 2010, or the BIFFAs to you and me. We meet a host of great actors, including Jared Harris or Lane from Mad Men, to find out about the future of British indie film. And the Swedish New Wave keeps rolling on. This week I speak to Lucas Moodysson about his international film Mammoth, starring Michelle Williams and Gael Garcia Bernal. Zan Brooks and I will be reviewing the week's releases, including Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis in Due Date. Mike Lee is the man for all seasons in Another Year, and there's a classy vampire remake about in Let Me In. Yes, it's more fun than a tea party. It's Film Weekly. Earlier this week in London, the tribe that is British Independent Cinema gathered at their annual rally, the launch of the British Independent Film Award nominations. In an open declaration of bias, I must say that I'm on the jury of the BIFFAs this year, but as a wholehearted lover of British Independent Cinema, that's no bad thing. But what sort of year is 2010 turning out to be? If you look at some of the nominations, from Clio Barnard's The Arbor to Chris Morris's Four Lions and Nick Whitfield's Skeletons, the suggestion is that it's a vintage one. But with the demise of the Film Council and the stark economic climate, the state of indie film here in the UK is in flux. So, with that in mind, I caught up with actor Jared Harris, Leslie Manville and many others to find out how they felt the future of British independent cinema might pan out.
Best Supporting Actress, Leslie Manville, Another Year, Helena Bonham Carter, The King's Speech, Rosamund Pike, Made in Dagenham, Kieran Knightley, Never Let Me Go, and Tamsin Gregg for Tamara Drew.
I've got Jared Harris here, who read out the nominations here at the BIFFAs, and for whom one of these awards is named, for your father, Richard Harris. I guess that he's kind of a figurehead of independent cinema because he had that independent spirit. What for you sums up independent movies?
Not satisfied with doing something the easy way. Finding a new way to tell a story, taking big risks, surprising your audience, not being happy with showing something that they've either seen before or have seen in the same way before.
So Jared, interestingly, obviously you know that UK film is under the cosh at the moment with the disappearance of the UK Film Council. You've probably been in America lording it up on Madison Avenue as Mad Men.
Which was shot in Los Angeles.
Anyway, but mentally... if you were to kind of come up with, if you were to ask, I know, Don Draper to pitch for UK film, British independent movies, how would he do it? How would he turn it around?
I think that film is the it's the most popular medium around the world, and you think of each movie as a little flagship sailing around the world, advertising your country and your culture to the rest of the world and attracting interest. So. It's great. Our problem here is actually that is the English language, because if America spoke its own language, our film industry would be ring fenced. But because we speak the same language, their films can show over here without being subtitled and stuff like that. So it's harder for us than it is for the French or the Italians and the Germans.
Yeah. But I mean, from what you can see, we got so much talent here. You read out the nominations. It's great performances, great actors, great stories. We've got the talent here. It's just a question of...
It's getting people to come and see them.
Yeah.
That's the tough thing to do. Because you can't make an argument for making films that people don't buy tickets to go and see. So, and how do you compete with the giant Hollywood mega movies that come out every weekend with $50 million of advertising behind them, and you've got a tiny little movie? I mean, it's tough, and that's the hardest thing, is trying to get people to buy British, support British, and that whole thing, and tell stories that people want to see over here, it's a hard thing to do, and it's made doubly harder because of the similar language.
Lovely to see you, Jared. I'm with Jamie Sivvis and Gemma Jones, two jury members here at the Biffers, alongside myself. Gemma, how lovely to see you.
Well, I'm very flattered to be on this jury.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to arguing with you a lot. We're going to see you in A Tall Dark Stranger, which aired in Cannes. Wonderful performance from you in that with Woody Allen. He's probably the godfather of independent cinema, isn't he?
Yes, absolutely. Quite anarchic, really, in that respect, yes.
Does he carry that through when you're working with him now?
Yes, he does. You know, he's very much his own person. I don't think he adheres to anybody else's rules but his own.
And do you get that spirit when you're working with him on set compared to anyone else? Because he has his own way of working. It's almost as if he's never really seen anyone else doing it. And does
well,
his own
he
way.
Does have his own way of working, which is quite enigmatic. Sort of takes getting used to because he doesn't say a great deal. But I enjoyed it very much.
Yeah. And what for you, as you're going to be on the jury, sums up an independent film?
Well, I'm afraid something that moves me, probably. You know, from being a girl, it's going to be a real challenge to watch something objectively and form an opinion about it, because normally I can just sit there with my Maltesers and weep, you know.
Yeah, we've got Jamie Sivvis here, who's also a regular feature in British independent cinema. Jamie, I mean, you know, without British independent cinema, and it's kind of under threat now, you've been in a lot of Film Council funded films, you know, where do you see it going? Is there enough work for you out there?
There's never enough work.
I knew you'd say that.
To be honest, it's an overcrowded business, and not enough films are getting made. But I think there's more and more help from overseas as well. There's lots of co-productions kicking about. A little bit of money from France, a little bit of money from Germany. Yeah, I'm quite hopeful actually. I'm not going to be too pessimistic about it. I think the wonderful thing about independent films is, hopefully, you don't have to kowtow to anyone, and you can just get out there and make what is. Reflects the initial screenplay or whatever it may be, the initial idea, you know.
Until then, we can fight as a jury members over the very essence of independent films, guys. Looking forward to it.
I'm going to start watching you on television now and take tips and echo your thoughts exactly.
Whatever I say is right.
Exactly.
Yeah. Thanks, Jamie, Gemma. I'm with Ruth Sheen and Leslie Manville, both nominated for Biffers this year. Congratulations, ladies.
Thank you.
For their fantastic work on Mike Leigh's Another Year. I wanted to talk about sort of working in British independent film, actually. We've spoken about working on Mike Leigh's productions in particular, and you were both so brilliant about it in The Observer this weekend. But working on an independent film in England and in Britain, it's going to get harder and harder to do, it seems to me, over the next couple of years. You two have done it brilliantly over the last... most of your careers.
Yeah.
How will it keep going? How is it going to survive?
Well, I mean, I think I'm sure Ruth feels the same, that we're very lucky to have this association with Mike, because, you know, the independent film industry is struggling, and, you know, I can only really think of one or two other films that I've made in England with independent companies outside of the work with Mike.
Yeah. I mean, the last couple of things I've done have been independent films. I did Philip Ridley's Heartless, which was a year or so ago. And, you know, I mean, it's always difficult to get money for film. And independent films have a harder time than, you know, anything else.
I mean, Mike is probably one of the most independent filmmakers in the world, given that he doesn't even start with a plot or a script or a character and all that. I mean, I don't think you can get more independent than that. And he struggles sometimes to get funding.
Oh, God. Well, I mean, this is his lowest budget for a very, very, very long time. And when you consider that since Secrets and Lies, he's had... all of his films have been Oscar nominated in one category or more than one category, but in one way or another. And we made Another Year for his lowest budget in decades. And certainly... you know, there was no raise of fees for me personally from working with him in 2002.
Yeah, so no one get in touch with Leslie Manville yet. Don't touch her for any money. She's got nothing. She's
no,
nicking.
I haven't
she's
got
taking
anything.
The Mac makeup here from the Biffa Lord. Has that ever annoyed? I mean, you two are so fantastic in Mike's films always. But if you were to become huge, huge stars, not that you're not, it's delightful to have you with us. But if you were to become huge, huge stars, you wouldn't be able to do that work anymore, would you?
Of course we would.
Why not?
Of course we would.
Not?
Thank you.
Champagne glasses tinkling in the background there. The awards are sponsored by Moët & Chandon this year, so champagne will be flowing when the awards themselves are announced on Sunday, December the 5th at Old Billingsgate Market. For a full list of this year's nominations and much more, go to biffa.org.uk. And I'm shaking early in the morning time. I'm delighted to say that one thing that was greenlit in the British film industry this week was Zan Brooks coming on Film Weekly to review the rest of the film's releases. Welcome back, Zan.
Thank you very much.
Zan, well, this week we'll look at Due Date, starring Robert Downey Jr. and Zach Galifianakis. We'll look at Another Year, of course, Mike Leigh's latest film. And we'll look at Let Me In, the remake of Let the Right One In, see how the Hollywood take on Sweden goes down with you. But let's start with Due Date, because it is the follow-up by Todd Phillips to The Hangover, the immensely successful The Hangover. But has it created a hangover in Phillips' career? Here's a clip before we talk about it, Zan. Here's Ethan, played by Galifianakis, telling Peter, played by Mr. Downey Jr., that his father's died.
How'd you get into architecture?
College. Anything else? Because I'm trying to...
I'm sorry, Peter. We're going to be traveling for a few days, and it wouldn't hurt to get to know each other.
Ethan, what brought you to Atlanta? Business or pleasure?
My daddy died. I went to Atlanta to go to his funeral.
Gee, I didn't know. I'm sorry.
He's the one that kind of motivated me to get on the TV.
I have a friend. He's in that industry.
Does he work on 2.5 Men?
No.
Man, that's too bad, because 2.5 Men is the reason I wanted to become an actor.
Right.
Especially the second season.
Why do you even have this?
Oh, because this is my daddy. These are his ashes.
Why are your father's ashes in a coffee can, Ethan?
Because he's dead, Peter.
A unique way of transporting one's ashes in a coffee jar. That will have later comedic hilarity ensuing on that little plot MacGuffin, Zan.
Oh, I missed that bit.
Did you? Were you asleep? I have to say that I was nearly asleep as this film began. Not because I hadn't got up. It was at 10:30 in the morning. I just thought, I've seen this before. I'd seen it.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there must be, presumably over in America, there are just, every freeway is filled with mismatched buddies taking road movies and falling over and getting into car wrecks. I mean, you know, where are they all? I've never actually met any of these people, but clearly they're out there.
Funnily, I've been on a road trip across America, not with a mismatched buddy.
Did you have a mismatched buddy?
Well, I kind of arranged to go with him, so it was my fault.
I'm trying to think, would I be your mismatched buddy?
I think we would.
I think that would be quite
people
bad,
would at least put a sort of Keir Starmer webcam on the dashboard to film us. At least arguing as we go about the merits of various art house movies.
It would be just, into. Wouldn't that be a great film?
There's an idea. Well, it's not much more of an idea than Powering Due Date here, to be honest.
It's not
you.
Really, is it? I mean, you know, to be fair, Todd Phillips has said that this is a sort of stopgap project between The Hangover, which came out last year and was a huge success, and The Hangover 2, which he has yet to make.
The basic plot, if you will, Zan, in three words.
Basic plot is Robert Downey Jr. as Peter, an architect who has to get to Los Angeles where his first child is about to be born, gets thrown off plane, has to hole up with Ethan, who's an aspiring actor, and they take off cross-country.
They do, because they can't get home in time for the birth of his child. I mean, the thing with Todd Phillips is, and I interviewed him for this show on The Hangover, which I thought was we'd seen The Hangover before as well, a sort of stag comedy gone wrong in Las Vegas. Many other, but The Hangover had this ingenious kind of plot where you had to kind of, you know, fit it in backwards.
Yeah, and it had the sense of, there were, you know, for all of its scatological kind of, you know, lowest common denominator thrills, there was a sort of sense of exuberance and bounce and ambition to it.
And a sort of a sense of male bonding as well. It was about what men do. I guess some of the women were kind of caricatured and ended up with Harrod, and you had the kind of prostitute, you had the kind of Harrod. And this one, however, neither of the characters were particularly, it wasn't like, oh, I see men bonding over a particular, I just thought they were kind of a bag of kind of character traits and nothing real.
Well, that's true. There was a point where I thought, is there something interesting in the fact that there's not important life lessons to be learned? I mean, always with these films, you get these two people who look, they're chalk and cheese. You know, they're never going to get along, but actually they do, and they've got something to teach the other person.
They share an essential humanity.
Yeah, and there's not really much of that in there. and maybe that's good, not to steer that old course.
No lessons, Seinfeld style.
Yeah, but there was nothing to replace it, apart from just, you know, the odd bit of hijinks.
Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of tired old kind of road race kind of thing when they kind of escape from Mexico.
Yeah.
This is a film that has a masturbating dog in it. Yeah. It's its basic kind of main joke.
That is the big joke.
I mean, The Hangover actually had a masturbating baby, didn't it? Matt Galifianakis
it did, which at least too. Is a bit more audacious.
Yeah, I think so. I thought this was really tired.
I thought it was really tired.
Surprisingly so. I expected a bit more. I mean, I laughed a couple of times, but both of those jokes involved the dog.
Both jokes involve the dog. The actors are sort of ballast, really, to the dog. I mean, Robert Downey Jr. is, you know, adequate, because he's always adequate.
Yeah,
he's always
fine.
Good. There's a good line in there where his character says, "I never take drugs," where you think, really?
I've never taken drugs in my life. Zam, we should go on to another year. Perhaps.
Let's go on to another year.
Yeah, which is very different. It is, of course, Mike Leigh's return to suburbia, this time starring a couple, Tom and Jerry, played by Jim Broadbent and Ruth Sheen. Here's a scene where their son, Oliver Maltman, playing Joe, and family friend Leslie Manville are all round.
Ah! What are you doing riding on the pavement, young man?
I'm breaking the law, officer.
Hey,
yeah.
How long did it take you?
About an hour.
You knackered?
I'm ready for bed.
Late night.
Hangover. Do you want a hand?
Yes, please.
I'll stick this away.
All right.
Here's Joe.
Hi, Mary.
Hello, Joe. What a surprise.
You all right?
I'm great. How are you? Oh, continental. It's all sweaty.
I've been riding all morning.
Have you? I like your hat.
Uh-huh.
Oh, that's right. Never forget to kiss your mum.
I never do.
No, you're a good boy, aren't you?
Yeah.
I remember when you were this big, you were a naughty boy.
I still am from time to time.
Oh, really? All these strong men. Look at his muscles.
That's why we had him.
Jim Broadbent, Ruth Sheen, Leslie Manville and Oliver Maltman there in Mike Leigh's Another Year. Zan, this is extraordinary in a way that Ruth Sheen and Jim Broadbent play a happily married couple.
Yeah, how's that for radical?
And that's it. They are a happily married couple. Yeah. You're expecting...
There's not a dark secret.
There isn't.
Not, a terrible meltdown. It's certainly not among them. And it's, but it's rare for a Mike Leigh film, but it's probably rare for any film.
I think it's rare for, there are no happy marriages in Shakespeare. I mean, and he wrote, 40 of the things. Mm. They're just normally not the sort of fodder for drama because nothing really much happens.
And yet within that, there is a great deal of interest. I mean, they play Tom and Jerry, who are ambling gently towards retirement.
Incidentally, yeah, Tom and Jerry, that is on purpose. They've learned to live with it.
They've learned to live with it. And their home is a sort of casual refuge, I guess, for these various tormented souls that crop up. Most notably, Mary, who's played by Leslie Manville there. But also Ken, who's this sort of overweight old buddy of Tom's, who sort of drinks too much. And also his older brother, Ronnie, who's this sort of blasted figure from the north, who just sort of comes down and chain smokes out in the garden.
And says, yep.
And they are a happily married couple and therefore a happy couple. But there's the interesting friction in this film is that from time to time, I thought that they were incredibly self-satisfied and smug. And maybe that is the interest of Mike Leigh's films, that they are proper social dynamics. Mm. And they're about how people define themselves in relation to other people. And so maybe one of the reasons why they are feeling so happy is because they've surrounded themselves with all these sort of wounded little animals. You know, it's the flip side of the thing that a little part of me dies when a friend is successful, that a little part of me is sort of bigged up when friends fail. And there's a sense that Tom and Jerry are happy because they're looking at their lives and thinking, we're not as bad off as these people.
Yeah. Except that when their son, Joe, does sort of find some happiness in a gentle gradation.
But his family.
Yeah, his family. So that's... Because she does get very hurt, Ruth Sheen, when her family is called into question, when Leslie Manville isn't happy for Joe.
Well, it's about overstepping the boundaries, isn't it? They're providing a sanctuary for these people, but the Leslie Manville character does not know when to back off and is basically just kind of a parasite who's feeding off them in search of something. You know, she's... maybe sort of early 50s, wondering whether life sort of passed her by and is in need of something. And then is, of course, fatally misreading the kindness of the people around her. And therein lies the sort of the drama that takes place in the second half.
A Mike Leigh film, where does it stand in his canon?
I think it stands very high. I thought that this was one of his most mature and refined and affecting films. A problem that people have traditionally with Mike Lee is that you get the sort of gaudy, garish caricatures thrown in there, the sort of the braying yuppies or the really shrill people. And so he does like those sort of pantomime villains or clowns dropping in there.
Yeah.
There's not really anyone quite like that in this. And I think that that made it more of a comforting film.
Interestingly, at the Biffers, we spoke to Routine and Leslie Manville. One is the supporting actress, one is the best actress. Which one's which?
Wow, that's I think Mike Lee would bridle at such a notion that there's a supporting actor and a, you know, they're ensemble pieces. I would say Leslie Manville main actress.
No, the other way around, the Routine really is, and Mike Lee has actually sort of made it that way. He wants Routine. It is about, the film is about Tom and Jerry, and everyone else is kind of subservient to them. But I agree. I was surprised that Leslie Manville wasn't the big turn. There's still hope for them at the BAFTAs. Apparently, they can rejig the BAFTA.
I'm sure this will get something. I mean, everyone thought it was going to win the big prize at Cannes, and it came away absolutely nothing.
Yeah, there's not a talking gorilla in it.
There's no talking gorilla, and that's something you might like to bear in mind for his next film.
Or a wanking dog. Perhaps. Big clues for Mike Lee's next film. Zanny could always include a vampire. I'd like to see Mike Lee try that as well, because it certainly worked for Swedish cinema when Let the Right One In was such a big success for Thomas Alfredson. So big, indeed, that Hollywood decided to pay it the ultimate compliment and remake it. Here is some vampires in New Mexico, no less, where a young vampire, played by Chloe Moretz, who's not perhaps so young after all, tells her new friend, played by Cody Smith McPhee, that he must fight back.
What happened there? Some kids from school? Where do you go to school anyway? I never see you.
Go and listen.
What?
You have to hit back. You have to hit back hard.
I can't. There's three of them.
Then you hit back even harder. Hit them harder than you dare. And then they'll stop.
What if they hit me back?
Then I'll help you.
But you're a girl.
I'm a lot stronger than you think I am.
Senna, you were a fan of Let the Right One In, I assume.
I was a huge
fan. Was it in your top five?
I think it was actually my number one. I think it may have been your number one.
It was in my top five, definitely. What were your feelings when you heard that Hollywood was remaking it?
Horror, I think. pure horror.
Put that on the
blood
poster.
Blood drained from my face.
And on seeing it?
On seeing it, well, let's take the next stage. The horror as well of a couple of weeks ago, you saying that this was, you'd seen it before me, and that it was better than the original.
I ventured in a kind of willful, devil's advocate kind of frisky way.
Right. I've seen it. It's very good. It's a good, solid, respectful remake. There is no way it's better than the original.
Right, okay. I think that it's a very different film to the original, and therefore that's why I thought it was scarier than the original.
Really?
I didn't find the original scary at all. I thought I loved it, but I thought it was more sort of like a social realist.
Well, it's certainly got the effects amped up a little bit more here, in that when the little girl vampire turns in, sort of goes properly vampiric, she looks like an orc out of Lord of the Rings, doesn't she?
Yeah.
She's got the kind of coloured contact lenses in and the grey face. Is that scary?
Yeah, I thought it was a bit sexier as well, this film. Yeah, I thought there was a bit more kind of sexual kind of element going on.
I think everything has been slightly amped up.
Yeah.
It feels like they've taken this sort of very dark, strange little film and thought, let's turn the lights on a bit, let's explain it a bit more. Doesn't work for me, really.
Yeah, I like being explained to.
Do you?
Yeah, I'm a bit stupid like that sometimes, so I kind of need it.
So here, you know, there's all these sort of weird little tensions that are never properly resolved in the original, like the character of the father.
Yeah.
And here you've got her saying, oh, he's not really my father, and here's some pictures of us when we were young, and things like that.
I found those poignant, you see, and that the lacuna in the original was, you know, I kind of played with that, but actually I thought this worked, and I like the 80s, Americanism. I like the Ronald Reagan on the telly.
Yeah, I thought that was okay. Felt a bit bolted on, but it was all right. I'm in an awkward position now because I'm having to sort of slag off this film that I did enjoy and thought was good. I thought both kids were...
No, you're not. You're slagging me off. That's fine.
I'm slagging you off. It's all your fault. Let's not blame the kids. The kids are very good. Cody Smith McPhee, I thought particularly, was very convincing. Chloe Moretz was good. Didn't quite have the same layers as the Lena Lee Anderson character.
She's more of a girl.
She's more of a girl. You'd never quite believe that she is old and old before her time, as it were. But you know, it's perfectly decent. The crucial thing for me that's missing from this is the drunks on the estate. That is the great hidden ingredient of the first film. That you've got this estate full of alcoholics who are kind of the happy hunting ground for the vampiress. But it brings a sort of tragic dimension to it, because it makes it into a film of the dispossessed and people who are living their lives in the shadows, and that nobody really gives a damn about these people, whether they're vampires or whether they're alcoholics. Here, you've got the isolated vampire, and it becomes a bit of a police procedure with the Elias Koteas character running around trying to catch the vampire. But that's more conventional, and that's more ordered as a sort of horror framework.
But that's why I like the Ronald Reagan thing. It made me think of a society of selfish individuals, that this could happen on, particularly the Rear Window kind of aspect, where they were looking into the different kind of windows. And I the woman who was the Catwoman in the first one is now turned into sort of bitchy kind of sexy girl who's got a kind of fur coat or something. And that one worked a bit for me. I thought the Catwoman was a bit odd. I like the detail of the film. I'm also slagging off a film which I really like.
This is the nature of our job. I thought this one might kind of
in terms of kind of having a mass audience, but actually it hasn't, because America hasn't really understood it in the first one at all, and it hasn't become a big hit at all. But I thought it was very stylishly done.
It's not an unnecessary remake, because the simple fact is that a lot of people won't go and see a subtitled film. So therefore, there's a film out there that they can watch that is a very good film.
I like the bullying in this one as well.
Did you? The bully was okay, but he didn't have the little kind of charm and cocksure swagger of the little Swedish kid. I'm defending the original.
Okay.
Go and see the original again.
That's fine. Or see Let Me In if you want to. Zan Brooks, thank you very much indeed. For more of Zan's interviews, musings, ideas, philosophical traits, go to guardian.co.uk/film.
Going out?
Yeah.
Yeah? Where are you going?
Planetarium.
All right. Well, I'll probably be gone by the time you get back. Hey, can I call you back in a minute? Yeah. Yeah, thanks. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye. I love you.
I love you too. How long will you be gone?
I don't know. I guess just a couple of days. Okay, goodbye, Gloria.
Goodbye. Have a safe trip.
Bye. I love you.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Yeah. I love you too.
Adios.
Gael Garcia Bernal in a scene from Lucas Moodysson's Mammoth, a multilingual transnational tale of divided families about the human cost of globalization. Gael plays a computer games whiz who has to go to Thailand on business, leaving his ER surgeon wife, Michelle Williams, to look after their child back in Manhattan. Now, Lucas Moodysson is perhaps the most established and most cinematically gifted of all the directors in the current Swedish New Wave. So I'm delighted to have Lucas on the line from Malmo now. Now, Lucas, welcome to Film Weekly. Thanks so much for coming on. And congratulations on Mammoth, a new film from you. It's always nice to have a new film from Lucas Moodysson. But in over the last couple of years, they've been, you know, you never know what you're going to get. Container was a difficult film. And now you've surprised us.
It's always nice to be able to surprise people, so that's part of my job, I guess.
It strikes me, it's very funny because, you know, you started with, say, Show Me Love, or and then the lovely film Together, Till Summons, and those films were sort of about family in a way, and then your other films were about the sort of sex trade, really, Lilia Forever, I'm thinking of in particular, and Hole in My Heart. And Mammoth is, in a way, a strange sort of softening in your heart, in a way, because it's about family, but it's also about the sex trade. It's about the coming together of both of those themes. Is that right, or is that coincidence?
I think the family and how we live together is one subject that always interests me. And then, of course, also, I'm not sure if I would say sex trade, but I would say that's how sort of our human needs are sometimes perverted. It doesn't necessarily have to be in the sex trade. It could also be something else. But I think that there is something enormously fascinating how we as human beings have these basic needs to touch people, or to have someone need us, and to all those things, and how that's so often turned into something that is destructive.
Sure.
And that interests me a lot.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that's what you get very much in Mammoth. You get the family unit that is so precious that could be then damaged by one bad decision or events outside. And in your film, there are mothers. I think there are three mothers in your film. Four mothers, if you count the absent one of the baby that Michelle Williams is operating on, because there's that mother. So there's four mothers, and there's absent fathers, and there's children with absent fathers. It's all about that. And I wondered if that was something that you'd been experiencing yourself as you were, as you got more and more successful as a filmmaker. You were being taken away to film festivals to work as well. If you were experiencing that kind of disconnect from your family.
Yeah, and especially doing Mammoth felt like a strange paradox, because it felt like I was doing a film about people who were staying away too much from their children, and while I was doing the film I was doing the same thing, so, and that felt quite stupid, actually. Didn't really make sense.
What, making a film that sort of says be near your children while you're away from your children? You're not listening to your own message.
No, it felt a bit strange, but on the other hand, I think it maybe helped me understand how it feels to be away from your children. At the same time, I think it helped me understand how it feels for people who don't have those options that I had, who are forced for mostly economical reasons to be away from their children and from their families for a very, very long time. And
it's
a situation that is very big, for example, in the Philippines, where part of the film takes place.
Yeah, absolutely. In some ways, is this your most ambitious project? I mean, I know everything else has had, maybe aesthetically ambitious, particularly Container, which was a sort of an extraordinary piece of art. But this one, in terms of filmmaking, you're filming in Manhattan, you're filming in Thailand as well. You had to kind of go on location. Was there a sense that this, is, as a filmmaker, was something very different for you?
Well, I think it felt like a movie where I was trying to, as you started to talk about, where I tried to combine things, and maybe in that aspect it's my most ambitious film. But otherwise, I'm not really sure, because I think I've made quite ambitious films before and sometimes succeeded, sometimes didn't. It felt like a big project, and it felt also like a very difficult project, and it felt like maybe this is the only time I make a film like that, because it took such a long time and such a lot of energy to travel like that and to, as I said, be away from my family and everything.
Is there, I mean, Lucas, it's lovely to have a film of yours back in the cinemas, but I mean, trying to remember the original Lucas Mutterson, and I was always very proud because the DVD of Together here in the UK was one of the first quotes that I had as a critic on the front cover. Cinematic sunshine to warm the soul, I said. I always remember it. And it said my name at the bottom, and I was like, oh, great, and I'm on the cover. Great. I'm on the cover of it here. So everyone had it, so it was a very proud moment. But actually, since then, your works have got a lot colder.
I think it's important to look at the world in different ways. And I think it's important to look at the bad things, but I think it's also important to look at the great things.
Have you changed as a person? Because you've obviously went through, that was such a lovely comedy with obviously some social satire.
But also at the same time, it feels a little bit, I've made that film and I made fucking Homo, which is also quite sunny.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure if I'm, if I want to continue to make the same film again. But at the moment, I don't know. I'm not sure what to do next. So maybe comedy, or maybe something funny, maybe something about the sunshine in the world. I'm not sure.
Well, if it is, then I'll take credit for pushing you back to the sunshine,
yes,
Lucas.
Yes.
But the what I wanted to say also was that remembering way back with fucking Amal, or Show Me Love, as we so politely call it here in Britain. It was Ingmar Bergman who said, he had that quote that said, oh, it's the work of the first work of a young master, the first masterpiece of a young master. How annoying was that? I mean, everyone brings it up to you now. It's become very difficult to live up to that.
Yeah, but he also said something else, actually, which was probably more important for me. But he said that because he didn't really like Together very much. Well, he said something like, it's a good film, but it's not as good as his first film. So now he has to... Now the only thing he has to do is continue to work. And I actually have that quote on my door in my working, where I work. And because I think it's really good that he sort of, like you said, the only thing to do now is to work. And I think it's sort of a very Swedish approach also, that you sort of, the only thing that you should could be proud of in your life is how much work you put in.
Well, that's, no, so he, that's, and I'm sure he'd be impressed by that you have continued to work and the themes that you've actually addressed ever since. I was going to go on. I think he'd be happy.
I don't know if he said something about the other films, but I'm proud of that at least.
So we don't know what you're going to do next, Lucas. But
well, actually, what I'm doing is actually sort of trying to write something else that is not cinema. So I'm actually writing. I've written a novel, and I'm sort of in a situation where I'm, you know, thinking about if I should spend the rest of my life making movies or if I should do something else. So I'm not even sure if it's going to be a movie. We'll see.
Oh, right. Well, I mean, well, novels are doing very well for Sweden as well, but I'm sure your novel is nothing like the Stieg Larsson's either. But I mean, if you don't make movies again, we will miss you. That certainly, I think you always contribute, as I say, a surprise. You never know what you're going to do next. So Moodyson by name, Moodyson by nature, perhaps, as well.
Yeah, well, maybe.
It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you, Lucas. Congratulations on Mammoth. It's a film that I thought was looked absolutely superb. I love your cinematographer, Marcel Ziska, who has worked with Michael Winterbottom and many others before. Yeah. I think he does fantastic work. I thought the aesthetics of it were just perfect as well. So congratulations on that. I hope it does well for you. And if you do come back to movies, come on Film Weekly. And if not, I'll have to get you on Books Weekly for your next novel.
Okay, thank you.
I'm okay alone, but you got something I need. Well, I got a brand new pair of roller skates. You got...
I know I was plugging it slightly in the interview with Lucas Moodysson there before, but I love his film from 2000, Together, or Tillsammans in Swedish. It's a beautiful comedy about a commune in the 70s in Stockholm. It's absolutely hilarious, but it's also kind of got a good social satire in there. It's a brilliant piece of work. He does go much darker with Ilja Forever, so if you're going to see one Lucas Moodysson movie, see Together. And that is all for this week. Last week, you may recall, we ran a competition to win the excellent The Kids Are All Right soundtrack. We asked you, where was Mark Ruffalo, our guest for the podcast, where was he born? As he said in the interview himself, he's from Kenosha, Wisconsin. We had loads of entries. Thank you to everyone who emailed in on our Facebook site. But the three names out of the hat are Andrew Blackman in Berlin. Guten Tag, sir. Helen Nottage from London and Frank Padgett, also from London. Congratulations to you three. Thanks to everyone, of course, but keep tuned for more competitions in the near future, I promise you. The music we've been featuring on this week's show was from the rather ludicrous but very entertaining soundtrack to Jackass 3D. Don't forget to pick up a copy of The Observer this Sunday. Trailer Trash is in there, of course, and the best film news and reviews. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on Film Weekly, Jason Phipps, till next week, it's goodbye.
Don't forget to start your free 14-day trial of audible.co.uk and to download your free audiobook. Head to guardian.co.uk/audible.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.